Almost 1,500 homeless Australians died prematurely each year. A Guardian Australian investigation has last year into 627 homelessness deaths since 2010 showed that rough sleepers died 30 years prematurely on average, an average age of just 44. Research from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare revealed last month that the annual death toll rising from 914 in 2012-13 to 1489 in 2021-22, a 63% increase. And to talk about this, I have on the line Heidi Tucker from Anchor. Hello, Heidi.
Hello, Robert.
I'm pleased you're there. Hello there. And Neil Taylor's here as well, from Holy Fools.
Yeah, g'day, Robert. G'day, Heidi.
G'day. How you going?
I'm doing well, thank you, on this wonderful day.
Well, Heidi, this is a serious matter, isn't it? Heidi Tucker, of course, is the CEO of Anchor Community Services. Neil Taylor's the CEO of Holy Fools of Lilydale and this area, and you have a shared passion. You're both frontline agencies, really, for homelessness in this area. And Heidi, this is a sad tale we hear in the Guardian. Who would like to start off? Perhaps Heidi, you could give us an idea of what this case was all about that was mentioned in the Guardian. Sure. It's a local relevance to Croydon.
Yeah, sure. I think for us that have been trying to get the messages out about homelessness for a very, very long time, and Neil is included in this, is that it is very hard to shift people to action, I suppose. People hear a lot about statistics and I think they think, oh, well, that's somebody else, and they don't really think about it. I think this Guardian article, which took a little while to come together, because what was really, really important was to show behind the face of Jermaine was a family, and a family that really cared and really loved him. And I guess, the article sort of goes through his journey. And I guess that, I reread it again this morning. What stands out is the opportunities lost for the system in intervening. So I think the most obvious one that's outlined in the Guardian newspaper is that when, Jermaine did the very right thing and thought, I need to go into rehab, and, he really, really tried it. Rehab is a very tough gig for people. But when he was ready to leave, there was just no help. And so he basically left into homelessness, which wasn't really going to assist his recovery journey. So I think, that stood out to me as an opportunity lost between, around the system. And also, too, I think the other thing that stood out for me, and I know the case intimately, obviously, the thing that stood out for me was Jermaine's initial absolute hesitancy to engage with anyone. He was actually out in a very remote area, and my workers, over quite a long period of time, engaged with him and got him to trust them. He'd had a lot of trust issues that people had let him down again and again. That obviously started when he was a child with an abusive father and then not very savoury stepfathers either. He didn't have much trust, but he started to gain trust. And, I remember talking to the women, my workers, over a period of time, and the sense of urgency of we've got to keep going, we've got to try and engage him, we've got to try and get him out of there, try and get him into housing. And there was this sense of urgency. I mean, it was almost like we knew we were running against the clock, that unfortunately Jermaine had, his body was deteriorating. We knew that. But I guess that we really, really hope that we could get him over the line and maybe start the recovery with engaging in some health services. And unfortunately, the system was too late. But I guess it just really shows you that he was such a young man. And I remember ringing another Aboriginal man who heads up a big Aboriginal agency, and I said, I'm just so sorry you've lost another warrior. I'm just so sorry. And we just can't keep doing that. We can't keep this going on for forever. So I think overall, Robert, I think what the Guardian article shows us is the opportunity to intervene, that there is a family behind these people. These people are not just invisible and nameless. They are a person, they're a loved one of someone, and that dying so young in homelessness is a tragedy we must not accept.
So just backtrack a little bit, reading from the article, if I may. The year before, we're talking about Jermaine, that's his real name. The year before he died, 29 years old he was, he'd given up his rental to go to rehab, and after 6 months he was sober and had nowhere to go, and he became homeless. Jermaine started sleeping by a creek in Lilydale, but his camping area was often attacked by people, and during winter his things got wet and mouldy. The temperature gets down to zero at night, and the caseworkers would from Anchor would check on him, and from Holy Fools too, I think, check on him regularly, take him new bedding or to a community lunch. And behind the scenes, they were desperately trying to get him into social housing. There just wasn't any. But then some social housing opportunity did arise right here in Croydon. Can perhaps Neil or Heidi talk about that?
Yeah. So, look, I think what this says to us is that, I mean, our experience is that every time there's a new block of social housing that's completed, and this one was completed by Community Housing Limited, each time, and we just had another one completed at Wanturna, and it feels like the pressure goes out of the system each time. You go, oh, thank goodness, you know, some of these people will be housed. But I guess that in Jermaine's case, one of the things that, you know, when you get a big block of apartments, and sometimes there's 200 or more of them, the housing provider, probably potentially quite rightly, sort of says, well, look, you know, we can't have too many really high needs people. You know, the girls were really at pains to try and convince the housing provider that once he moved in, that they would certainly be there with him, they would certainly support him. And you know, and they would do all they could. I think the thing is, Robert, and a couple of years ago, I remember going to a conference, and there was a couple of politicians there. We were talking about children, and we were talking about children coming into homelessness with their mothers. And I put up my hand, and it was a bit controversial at the time. And I remember a couple of years ago saying to a politician that actually the children that were in homelessness today and the ones born into homelessness today can't wait your 10 years to build your accommodation. So I think this is the problem, is it takes so long to build this accommodation.
We'll take up the story there from The Guardian. The year before Jermaine died, he'd given up his rental, as we said, but when he made it into social housing in March last year, this his time of sleeping rough stayed with him, and unused to a proper bed, he slept on the couch, and he kept his shoes on at night in case he was asked to move on. So within 6 weeks of living in his new home, Jermaine, whose last name has not been used, but it is his first name, was dead. One of 137 built last year in Croydon came too late. And they say his death was preventable, and his family don't want this to happen to anyone else. That was the theme of the article.
I would add with what Heidi's saying, that no one who is homeless should die because of homelessness. We've had many people over the last 15 years or so who have been homeless, who have passed away, you know, and each of those deaths, you know, just devastates me. And I know for a fact that pretty much all of them have got family that, much like in the story with Jermaine, that are behind them, that are grieving and confused, I guess, that, you know, this person was homeless, and why they were in that position, and how can they died? You know, what could have been done to change their lives so that they actually didn't die? Well, he had a gentleman similar to Jermaine, but this guy had a family of his own, wife and kids, and, you know, he was an alcoholic but slept rough and didn't take care of himself. And I guess that's part of the issue, I guess, with some of the chronic homelessness, is that there's a bit of alcoholism and also lack of self-care. He ended up passing away and leaving his wife and kids and his family sort of holding a question mark and saying, you know, could this have been prevented? And I said, yes, could have been prevented.
You're saying the same thing, aren't you, that there have been three or five deaths in the last year or so that you're aware of in this same way?
I think the other thing to say for the audience is that one of the things that Council on Homeless Persons have been trying to do, and I'm on the board of that organisation, is trying to get the coroner in Victoria to register the cause of death being homelessness, because we know that if the cause of homelessness comes through from the coroner, you know, as the cause, then that will trigger the system to, you know, look into that further and perhaps provide some more resources in that area.
You know from first-hand experience, and Neil as well, from your workers, that the numbers are there. It's just a case of having it officially endorsed by the coroner and statistics gathered around Australia, as with so many other social issues, that then brings attention to the government, etc.
I think part of the issue is going to be also is that there's a comorbidity usually occurring with their deaths too,
right.
Alcohol and other issues.
Yes, and so many other health issues that manifest with homelessness. I mean, I'm thinking of dental care in particular. That's a big one, isn't it?
Yeah, no. Look, it really is. And I never forget when I very first started with Anchor 10 years ago or so, this man saying to me, and, you know, he was very articulate, had been homeless for a while, sleeping rough, different places. And he said to me, you know, like I said something about, oh, looking after his health. He said, well, how am I supposed to do that? I don't have any fridges to keep medication cold. I don't have, you know, I don't necessarily have access to a pharmacy all the time. What do you expect me to do? And I think that's the thing is that homelessness, you know, if you don't have a sort of a focus of homelessness for someone with their health, then you are just going to try and treat them like you would just mainstream, you know, like the mainstream.
Yes, and I imagine if you're a diabetic, for example, keeping your insulin and you know other things that you need to keep in a fridge must be very difficult.
Yeah, or just in one place and not in a backpack. You know?
Oh, of course. A challenge for Heidi and Neil: what can be done? I mean, you talked about advocacy, obviously, as frontline organisations. You're right at the cutting edge, and you're doing all you can and more. Beyond your resources, I'm sure. What can the listener do? Advocate, perhaps? Donate?
I think that some of the first things people can do is learn more about it. And I think there's definitely lots of ways people can get involved, not only from donating or volunteering with organisations that work with there, but also, you know, advocating, as you said. You know, there's letters they could write to both state and federal government about this issue. Find out more about organisations like CHP and Homelessness Australia and see what, you know, if you can add to what their voice is saying, because there's some great campaigns being done by both those organisations.
I think that's right. I think that's right, Neil. And we do have a federal election coming up.
That's right.
And then we have a state election next year. It now is the time to put this on the agenda of politicians. But I guess, in a sense, you know, what I've learned from lots of engagement with politicians, they also need solutions. So, it's probably not really enough for them to sort of just, oh, my God, there's just, you know, overwhelming problem. But, for instance, you know, give solutions. And I think of something like Domaine's case, where when he came out of rehab, the system must be able to accommodate and provide something for someone like that who's worked so hard to become sober. And, you know, we're not talking large numbers, but, you know, if we talk to politicians and say, can you please make available a house or, you know, a flat probably for someone like that? Can we just have some capacity in the system? Because as Neil knows, there's thousands and thousands of people waiting for social housing. And I just think that, you know, we all know that, but can we really focus our resources on when it could make the most difference? You know, we have the same issue that Jermaine had in coming out of rehab as we have with women who decide, right, enough's enough, I'm actually getting really battered and beaten here, I need to leave. And we have so many women that come in and go, look, I just really need accommodation, then I can, you know, like my kids and I can settle again, we could just, you know, I can probably get a job later and afford some private rental, but right now I can't. And we just say, sorry, you know, one or two nights in a motel. And I think that's the problem, is when people are at their most desperate and ask us for help, we can't help them. And you know, and we go, oh, well, we might be able to do this, or might be able to do the other, and you think, well, what is that saying to that person? That's saying to that person, you're not important, the person doesn't really care, I just think, can we focus our resources to, you know, the absolute pointy ends where we can make a difference?
I totally agree. I would also add that there are lots of people who are exiting hospital, whether it's psychiatric care or actual hospital. Mm. They're being exited into homelessness. Mm. There are many people that we've encountered that who you know, you would have thought that if they needed additional care when they came out, it's non-existent. They're exiting, being forced to basically get into a taxi and drive to down the street and dumped, is my case. Whereas I was always under the impression that the hospital was under sort of duty of care to ensure that there was some sort of follow-on, but it doesn't seem the case.
I think what we're reading in the press in the last few days is that the hospitals have a problem and discharging people when there's nowhere to go. There isn't a system as there once was. And so they're keeping them in hospital in many cases, patient, just generally speaking. And then, of course, there's a crunch at the other end through admissions, can't be admitted. Yeah. So it's, it goes right down the line. So it comes, look, you could say it comes down to prevention, early intervention and all that sort of stuff. Why are these people homeless? You know, you could take that holier-than-thou approach, which is wrong, of course. But and I thought it might be timely to relate the story of Omi. Now, Omi is a very successful story from Anchor. We've heard this before. I might just play that now, if I can, Heidi, because I think to hear someone's story is really important.
Yeah,
my name is Omi, and I'm 20 years old. I feel like people would be surprised that, like, I've had a really dark past, because I come across as quite, like, bright and happy. I left my home because of fighting and just not being treated right. It felt safer for me at the time to be away from there. I was homeless in the city, and because I was out on my own, I didn't feel like I could trust anyone, like, because I'm a girl. Scary. Really scary. Anchor helped me with achieving my goal of entering a floristry course. They helped me set that up. They gave us an amazing community. We do activities once a week on a Wednesday. I have amazing support from my worker. I'm proud of how far I've come. I've grown into myself a lot and become a lot more mature, because I know that I'm supported and I'm going to be all right. And I've got somewhere that I know that is safe. Anchor's really changed my life and helped me achieve my goals and dreams and feel like I'm successful.
And Heidi, that's a good story, that one.
It is really good for the audience to hear that, because in actual fact, we do have successes in programs that are well-tailored to, say, young people like Omi that find themselves homeless. Which is the Youth Warrior Program, and we have these tailored approaches that, you know, specifically offer a couple of accommodation and for them to finish their schooling and to finish becoming independent. It's really, really critical, because I guess in a way what we're doing, Anchor's doing, is finishing off, I guess, you know, and this is a bit crude, but finishing off perhaps where families have not been able to finish the job of growing that young person up. And I think what we see with kids like Omi is that there's a fork in the road. They can either go down one pathway or go down another pathway. And I think to myself about Jermaine, you know, when I think of Omi, and I think, what could have happened, you know, if we'd seen him at 18 or 19? Apparently, according to his family, he was very intelligent, a really lovely guy, which we found that he was a really lovely person. What could have happened? This didn't need to happen to him.
And that's the early intervention I spoke about, isn't it, really? Yeah. Getting people
well,
early.
Well, just intervening quickly when someone, particularly young people. I mean, that at those ages of six, we all know from having our own kids, but, you know, 16 to 25 is just those solidifying years where, you know, they're not kiddies anymore. But they're not fully grown up either. They're not the full product. And those, they're such sensitive years that we they need those supports. They need the, you know, the places to make mistakes and to be picked up again and moved on. We know that that age group, you know, we know that, that we all went through that ourselves, where we changed and we shared houses and we moved here and we did this and we did that. These kids need the same support that we all got as young people to thrive, to get on with their lives. And, you know, with Omi and other kids like her, what do we all want? We want them, you know, we don't want them to go down the Jermaine pathway where they end up costing the system a lot of money, not that that was his fault, but, you know, it ended up costing a lot of money, a lot of hurt for families and things, and yet we could have intervened early.
The story of Omi is fantastic, and unfortunately, I think we need more stories like that. But I think, you know, part of the issue is that the system is becoming so overwhelmed with the sheer number of people that it's very hard now for us to, for any of the services. I know, you know, in hearing from other services that it's hard to be able to help people because there's just so many people wanting help. You know, not only from sort of homelessness services, but all the way through to, say, food services and things like that as well for welfare services. Just the sheer volume of people coming through is scary.
The food banks would all tell us they're completely overwhelmed.
And, I think we're seeing a lot more people, and I know you guys are too, and it's just more and more people who wouldn't normally seek help in that regard are now turning to us and to you guys and other organisations and saying, hey, I need a bit of a hand here.
So good advice there from Heidi Tucker and Neil Taylor. Heidi's the CEO of Anchor Community Care. Neil Taylor is the chief of Holy Fools, Inc. And same message there, advocacy, particularly coming up to elections, and perhaps some donations or volunteering your time. Let's not forget that. And maybe we could provide some phone numbers or some contact points now for both Anchor and Holy Fools. Do you have a number, Neil, that people can call?
Yep, they can call the office on 1300 133 889.
1300.
133 889.
And Heidi, do you have a number, an easy number? You've got a...
People can go to our website, anchor.org.au.
Yeah, best place to go because you have other services you provide and ultimately
it goes through a single... We do, we have lots of services, yeah.
Thank you both for spending time this morning on
the
program.
Thank you, Robert.
Yeah, thank you, Robert, and appreciate the fact that you're interested in sharing this sort of information with your listeners.
I think it's so important come back again when there's next day development.
Yeah.
Wish you well for this wonderful day. Thanks, Heidi.
Thank you.
And thank you, Neil.
Yeah.